Recently, I've engaged in learning about many wacky and unusual topics. I mean, we've looked into these extremely weird topics like quantum entanglement, the standard model of particle physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, black holes, supernovae, the types of galaxies, the types of stars, and many other interesting topics over the last few months. And they've become consistently more wacky, consistently wackier, and consistently more unusual. A physics PhD I'm connected with often helps me through some of these topics, and that's one of the reasons why I've been getting into some of these weird, wacky topics. But even then, I've still found myself making significant amounts of mistakes. That is undoubtedly going to happen when you have a limited understanding of a specific topic, and when you are doing all of it by yourself every single week as a 16-year-old. So I guess cut me some slack, but still, I mean, it's bound to happen, either or, anyways. It's bound to happen no matter what. But he helps me with a lot of these topics, including specifically the Hilbert space and the Higgs field. I've asked basically every weekend I ask him, I text him, asking him a question about quantum mechanics because most of the time I don't really understand it. Most of the time it takes a little bit of a little bit of a simple English dictionary to understand it. And even then, doesn't really work out well because remember that I have no basis on physics. I have no basis from physics, and this is significantly difficult for me to be able to pull off every weekend with difficult topics. But I found them to be very extremely fun. But understand that I do make a mistake every weekend. That won't be the case forever. Once I have an understanding of this, if I continue this through college, I probably will be able to make these without any problems at all. But for now, I cannot say that I can make them without problems. But anyways, through this physicist, through this, in engaging with this physicist over these topics, I learned how shallow my understanding of quantum mechanics is, how shallow my understanding of physics in general is, to be honest. Even throughout the various topics we have discussed in depth, I have found that I lack a fundamental understanding of not only quantum mechanics and particle physics, but physics itself. I plan for this chapter to be one of the last in which we cover extremely advanced quantum mechanical and particle physical topics, for I wish to gain an understanding of basic physics before I enter the treacherous depths of the Wild West of physics. It is often said, for example, by Michio Kaku, that they often will fail their entry-level physics kids because the kids often will get extremely interested in quantum mechanics and in particle physics. Think that the topics are completely separate from one another, and they will go straight to quantum mechanics and particle physics, thinking that they know everything that exists, when that is not even close to true. That is not even anywhere near the truth. You require a fundamental understanding of physics to be able to experience and understand the world in which we live, specifically the quantum mechanical and the particle physical world. Now, the problem with youth is that they love interesting and difficult things. But the problem with that, again, is that they're interesting and difficult things, and interesting and difficult things always require a fundamental understanding. And the problem is, many don't have a fundamental, many, including myself, do not have a fundamental understanding of some of these physical topics, and that's why I'm going to be switching to other particle or other physical topics. I'm still going to be discussing in depth a lot of the quantum mechanical stuff because it's extremely interesting, but I think it is important to understand basic physics before you get into the crazy stuff. So we're going to be talking about thermodynamics, we're going to be talking about Newton's laws, we're going to be talking about the inverse square law, we'll probably talk about a bunch of different things. We'll talk about kinematics, we'll talk about conservation of energy, conservation of matter, conservation of all that, because all of it is extremely important. And then we'll probably bring it into the relativity stuff, so like into the field equations, general relativity, special relativity, and more the relativistic physics, and then use that in an understanding of space-time to get into the real extreme topics that are going to require a year of physics to understand in depth. Now, I don't understand any of these things in depth, which is a reason as to why I am going to be going into different topics that are not entirely derived from quantum mechanics. I will admit, though, that the reversal back to classical mechanics will not only be difficult, but likely will not happen entirely. I think we will transition somewhat, partly, but I'm not really sure it's going to happen entirely, because I do really like making these videos and these episodes and these chapters. I'm just very interested in all of this and in traveling into the depths of stuff that confuses me, because, again, it is hard to be confused. It is not easy to be confused in this world, so I need something that can confuse me, and quantum mechanics confuses me, so perfect. Although, again, there still remains a lot to learn in classical mechanics. I still have a very limited understanding of it, so of course we're going to be going into classical mechanics. I think we'll probably just split it up. Like, every other weekend we do an episode on physics, every other weekend we do an episode on, like, quantum mechanics and particle physics. But anyways, in this chapter, we are going to be discussing quantum chromodynamics, which is the theorized strong interaction between two basic elementary particles, the quarks, which is a type of elementary particle, and the gluons, which is a gauge boson, which will be discussed and understood. As it is known from the chapter on quarks, scientists once considered hadrons to be elementary particles in and of themselves. This created a significant number of elementary particles that generally led scientists to consider there to be too many particles. They called it the hadron zoo, or the particle zoo. They really called it the particle zoo because it was kind of just a zoo of a massive amount of particles, considering there are thousands of hadrons. But it was soon discovered that many of the hadrons could be grouped into separate types based upon their intrinsic properties. So, not every hadron is made up of the same things, and not every hadron has the same quantum numbers, has the same intrinsic characteristics, which means that they can be grouped into different categories in a way. Murray Gell-Mann, arguably my favorite physicist ever because of his literary knowledge, Mr. Gell-Mann named the quark after a specific quote in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. If you have not read that, I have not either, but if you have, good for you, because I've heard it's one of the most difficult books to read. It's slightly less difficult than Ulysses, but Ulysses is just as hard as to read as any other book, just as hard to read as the worst book ever written. I thought Pride and Prejudice was difficult to read at first. That was not difficult compared to Ulysses. But anyways, Mr. Gell-Mann, when he discovered the quark, he named it after the specific quote in Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce. It was essentially three quarks for Muster Mark. Sure, he hasn't got much of a bark, and sure, any he has, it's all beside the mark. Gell-Mann initially named it the quark after this because Joyce wrote specifically three quarks, which essentially represented the number of known quarks at the time. At the time of the proposal of the quark model, the only quarks that existed were the up quark, the down quark, and the strange quark. And that's three flavors. But of course now there are not three flavors, there are six. But still, three quarks for Muster Mark. Like, three quarks. Three. It's kind of interesting how stuff like that comes from just, like, literary understandings. But yeah. And because of his discoveries, he invented what is known as the eightfold way, which essentially organized the various hadrons into groups, again, based on their intrinsic characteristics. As was also discussed in the chapter on quarks in 1963, the physicist Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig, or it might be Zweig, I think it's Zweig, proposed the quark model, which documented that the hadrons, like the mesons and the baryons, were not elementary particles, but rather composite particles composed of a number of smaller true elementary particles, which are also known as quarks. Immediately following this proposal, Gell-Mann proposed a quantum field theory that grouped together the interactions between the quark and the gluon. The quarks experienced significant conflicts from the beginning. As they were classified as fermions, they were confined to the Pauli exclusion principle, which we know explains that no two fermions in the same volume, or within the same, essentially surrounding the same thing, or within the same particle, can have the same quantum numbers. There exists a particle composed of three strange quarks with parallel spins, which is essentially holding the same quantum numbers. This particle is known as the omega minus hyperon. The hyperon is a baryon composed of one or more strange quarks, just in case you did not know that. I'm sure you probably didn't, because I didn't even know what the hyperon was until now. But because of the fact that the omega minus hyperon or baryon holds three quarks with the same quantum numbers, and because of the fact that the quark is a fermion, this baryon should not follow the Pauli exclusion principle. Considering the fact that this particle exists and is known to exist, physicists had to solve the problem. The obvious answer, which I'm sure probably some of you guys actually came up with, and I actually came up with it before I even read it, because I was thinking the same thing. The obvious answer to this was to this conflict was that the quark held an additional quantum number, and this is basically what chromodynamics itself is based upon. The PhD student Boris Struminsky, the first to propose an additional quantum number in the quark, don't even know how you could be the first. I feel like everyone who even looked at that experiment probably would think so, because that's kind of like a common sense hypothesis. But anyways, he wrote, when referring to the omega minus hyperon, three identical quarks cannot form an antisymmetric S state. In order to realize an antisymmetrical orbit, an antisymmetric orbit, orbital S state, it is necessary for the quark to have an additional quantum number, end quote. I didn't even start the quote, but end quote. The omega minus hyperon was not the only composite particle to fall under scrutiny for its odious conflict with the Pauli exclusion principle. For another particle, the delta plus plus baryon, delta positive positive or something, 2 is composed of 3 quarks, in this case up quarks, with identical quantum numbers and parallel spins. So you obviously have a significant situation in which they have the same quantum numbers, so there must be another quantum number that explains something like this, because again, they're confined to the Pauli exclusion principle, and we know that they are fermions, so it has to do with an additional quantum number. And we know that they're fermions because they have one-half integer spins. The boson has a one-half integer spin, or not the boson, the quark, and because of that, we know that it's a fermion, not a boson, which has an integer-valued spin. And in 1973, the additional intrinsic property of quarks, the color charge, was first proposed. The color charge is simply the property of the gluon in the quark that relates the particle's strong interactions in the theory being discussed in this chapter. The color charge helped resolve the issues and conflicts between composites like the omega hyperon, the omega minus hyperon, and the delta positive positive or plus plus baryon against the Pauli exclusion principle. In these composite particles holding multiple of the same quark flavors with parallel spins, the various quarks can now hold different color charges. It could either be red, blue, or green, or in the case of anti-quarks, the color charge would be the anti-color of red, blue, or green. So it'd be anti-red, anti-blue, anti-green. Also remember, for the love of God, it's not the actual color system. The quark is not red, the quark is not blue, and the quark is not green. Scientists are just stupid. Richard Feynman called them idiot physicists after they did it, because obviously it's going to cause a significant amount of confusion, and it did, and it still does, because people think that quarks have colors, but they don't have colors, and they're even represented as having colors, but they don't have colors, at least not colors we would think of. Not red, blue, and green. They are not on a red, blue, green digital color scale. It just doesn't work that way, because this is physics. This is the universe, not your computer. But anyways, the quantum number, the addition of this quantum number, which was discovered, would not defy the Pauli exclusion principle. In this year, quantum chromodynamics itself was first proposed when physicists Murray Gell-Mann, Harold Fritsch, and Heinrich Luttweiler applied Yang-Mills theory, a theory that attempts to describe the behavior of elementary particles through special unitary groups, see chapter 32, to propose that carrier particles of a force, the gluon is a vector boson, the carrier particle of the strong force, can radiate additional carrier particles. So in quantum electrodynamics, which conveys the relationship between the photon carrier of the electromagnetic force and matter, photons cannot radiate additional photons. So that's essentially the difference between electromagnetism and quantum chromodynamics and quantum electrodynamics. There are some differences between electrodynamics and chromodynamics, but we will get into them. A lot of it deals with basically interactions. Again, this all deals with the interactions. I mean, that's basically what it is in general. But anyways, let's get to the crazy stuff. So anyways, quantum chromodynamics and color charges were both later represented by numerous counts of empirical observation. We know that because we've seen it, which basically proved their existences and resolved problematic conflicts with the Pauli exclusion principle. Quantum chromodynamics is now a significant doctrine in fundamental particle physics and holds significance in the Standard Model. And when I mean significance, I mean major significance. It holds a particular significance in the Standard Model because it relates a specific type of elementary particle with the gluon, with the mediator of the strong force. So obviously it holds significance in the Standard Model. Before this concept is conveyed, it is important to know that this is a scientific theory. A scientific theory is a well-developed, basically theory, and holds a wide body of experimental evidence implying or directly indicating its existence, for the most part directly indicating. QCD2 is a theory, meaning it has a significant amount of empirical evidence proving its existence. Various scientific concepts we have discussed in the past are often theorized, but are not theories in scientific terms. That's why I try to avoid theorized. I normally say hypothesized, because there's a significant difference between a theory and a hypothesis. A hypothesis is like an inference. It is an educated guess as to what may happen when an experiment is conducted. But a theory is a widely understood and a widely accurate scientific doctrine that has existed and has been tested for long periods of time through many different essentially experiments, and without yet having a piece of significantly conflicting data that directly indicates that it doesn't exist. And that has not happened with quantum chromodynamics, that has not happened with evolution, that has not happened with the Big Bang Theory. So all of them are very well understood, and all of them are scientific facts. Supersymmetry, for example, though, in terms of hypotheses, has been theorized, but it's most certainly not a theory, for it has no empirical basis. Quantum chromodynamics, to get into it, is a theory that relates the quark and the gluon together through the strong interaction. This particular theory is similar to quantum electrodynamics, for it relates a fundamental force with various particles. So if you know what quantum electrodynamics is, basically relates the electromagnetic force with matter, with whatever matter, and that's where it's similar, I guess. That's essentially where it's similar. And remember that the whole thing, this is based almost entirely on color charge. So you're going to have to think about this. Everything has to do with color charge. The interaction is fabricated by this whole color charge quantum number. We will discuss the color charge relatively somewhat in depth, but it is important to understand that the whole theory of QCD, quantum chromodynamics, is based upon that particular quantum number. That's how we developed the theory. QCD is a type of quantum field theory, otherwise known as a non-abelian gauge theory, which deals specifically with non-abelian or non-commutative Lie groups in abstract algebra. Yeah, I have never learned abstract algebra, but this is whatever. A non-abelian gauge theory, also known as simply as a gauge theory, is a type of quantum field theory in which the Lagrangian, the quantity that characterizes the state of a particle, is invariant under local transformations, which basically means that it displays a mathematical symmetry when faced with transformations under certain Lie groups. I kind of like to think of, when I think of this, I don't think it's correct, but when I think of this, I like to think of eigenvectors and eigenvalues. In vectors, when you perform a transformation to a graph, there are, in basically every transformation, in some transformations, there are values that remain the same, there are values that remain the same, and there are values that don't remain the same, but in those specific areas in which it remains the same, that's an eigenvalue. So I like to think that a non-abelian gauge theory is essentially similar to this. It's invariant under local transformations. So this field theory is invariant under the local transformations. Its symmetry group is a special unitary triplet represented by SU parentheses 3. The SU3, or the special unitary triplet, is an 8-dimensional Lie group consisting of all 3x3 matrices with a determinant of 1. Remember last episode when we were speaking specifically of the first time that we were talking about special unitary groups, we were learning about how the discriminant must be 1, how the discriminant in the special unitary doublet must be 1, and how there are only 3 dimensions in, or 3 parameters within that specific, within the specific matrices. Now, this is an 8-dimensional Lie group, 3x3 matrices, 3x3 matrix, and technically that would be 8 dimensions, and you can apply the one dimension to the thing we discussed in the last episode. I think it's probably going to be the same thing, but I cannot assume that, for I do not have the evidence for it. But anyways, in QCD, the electric charge is represented by the color charge. So all of this deals, again, with the craziness of the quantum chromodynamics. There's a reason that people don't upload videos like this on YouTube. It's because they're very difficult for people to understand without significant research. Again, this is why I always ask every single episode that you guys do research for yourselves, because it goes so much further than what I'm speaking of right now that you really do need that extra push from Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is highly, highly technical, but it is very understandable. So if I could say anything, just please, please use Wikipedia. You go online and search up stuff involving this, because you will find an absolutely incredible amount of information. That's why I do this, because you find so much new you find so many new things from it. But anyways, the color charge is represented by the colors red, green, and blue. While it is not as simplistic as quantum characteristics like spin and electric charge, the color charge holds similar dynamics. Simple dynamics and phenomena that help distinguish it from other quantum numbers. So due to a phenomenon in the strong interaction known, this is an example, known as color confinement, no free particle or quark unbound to everything has a color charge. They essentially have a color charge of zero, not even of white or of black, it is just zero. In composite particles like baryons, which are composite particles composed of three quarks, no quark can have the same color charge. Thus, there will exist one quark with a red charge, one with a green charge, and one with a blue charge. Do you see how this does not violate the Pauli exclusion principle? It is because they do not hold the same quantum color charge, which means that they don't have the same quantum numbers, which means that they're not violating the Pauli exclusion principle, which means that they are able to exist within the same hadron together. Now, this is significant because in the case that they were defying the Pauli exclusion principle and we had not a single quantum number that would fix the problem, we may have to come up with a complete new class of fermions or a complete new class of elementary particles, which are based not upon their spin, but upon other specific dynamics. Now, anyways, in hadrons, which are composite particles composed of an equal number of quarks and antiquarks, or this is specifically mesons, I'm sorry, not hadrons. The quark may have any color charge, while the antiquark has the exact opposite color charge, or the antiquark, or the anticolor of the quark's color. Essentially, if a meson exists with a red-colored quark, it will exist with an anti-red antiquark. As physicists are crazy, color charge is not in any way synonymous with actual colors, of course. Quarks are still colorless from what we know, unfortunately. The color charge is not necessarily comparable to electric charge, for they hold different properties. For example, electric charge has only one kind of value, while the color charge very obviously has multiple kinds of values because they're different colors. Although color charge, like electric charge, has negative charges that apply to these values, so that's pretty obvious. In quantum chromodynamics, the gluon is, of course, the force carrier. This portion of QCD is similar to the existence of the photon as the force carrier in quantum electrodynamics, which is another significant quantum field theory in particle physics. We know that the gluon is the force carrier. This is not a question. The gluon is one of two massless particles that are gauge bosons. They're one of the two only known massless particles that exist, unless you talk about the zero Higgs field, which is technically non-existent. There is the zero Higgs field, which that's different. It doesn't necessarily produce anything. So technically, it's not necessarily a massless particle, but the photon and the gluon are the only two massless particles known. Now, they are both the mediators of the two strongest forces, the electromagnetic force and the strong force. Strong force for the gluon, electromagnetic force for the photon. They are intrinsically different from one another. They are undoubtedly different. They're inherently different from one another, but they certainly do exist with similar qualities, and meaning that they experience the laws of physics, the laws of space-time, and they also are massless. But the electromagnetic force and the photon follows the inverse square law, while the strong nuclear force and the gluon do not. But anyways, in QCD, there exist two main properties. The first property, of course, is color confinement, which we've discussed earlier, but it was a very vague detail. Color confinement results from the constant force between two different color charges as they are separated. Color confinement is wacky in the sense that it requires a significant amount, an increasingly significant amount of energy to separate quarks in a hadron. So essentially to the point at which the energy spontaneously produces literally a quark-antiquark pair, or a meson. This creates a new hadron and not a separated color charge. This explains why color charge does not exist in isolated quarks. For quarks with colors are intrinsically connected to other quarks in a way that makes it impossible for them to detach from one another through the strong force. It requires so much energy that it just creates a new hadron. That's essentially what it does. That's how much energy it requires. It literally will not. That's how the strong force works, apparently. The second intrinsic property in QCD is asymptotic freedom. Asymptotic. Technically, it's asymptotic because asymptote or asymptotic, but I'm calling it asymptotic because it sounds better. Does one remember what an asymptote is? Just in case you do not, think of the function f of x equals 1 over x squared, which is the inverse square law, and that is the most important, like, simple function in physics, probably. In this particular function, near x equals 0, the separate curve rises towards infinity, never reaching 0, 0 x equals 0. An asymptote is essentially an unreachable x or y value on any particular graph function. Not every function displays asymptotes, for the x value in f of x equals x squared can equal 0, while the x value in f of x equals 1 over x cannot equal 0, as 0, 1 over 0 is undefined. We all know that 1 over 0 is undefined, but 0 over 0 is not technically undefined. It's just indiscriminate or indeterminate. It's an indeterminate form. It's called L'Hospital's rule. I learned that on Khan Academy. Go on to Khan Academy. It's very useful. But anyways, the asymptotic freedom phenomenon occurs in quantum chromodynamics, conveys that there occurs a steady decrease in the strength of the strong interaction between gluons and quarks as the energy scales of the interactions increase and the distance scales decrease. Yeah. Like, just try to think of it. So as it gets closer, the strength decreases, the strength required decreases, but the energy does increase. The energy scale increases, but the strength of the interaction decreases. I would assume it's because there is not as much of a need, or like not necessarily like need, but it's not like it requires less energy, or it requires less strength to be able to keep it together, but the energy scale increases, something like that. But yeah, so this phenomenon itself earned three physicists the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics. While quantum chromodynamics is certainly a well-cemented theory in particle physics, it too has its limitations. An example of this is the charge parity problem, also known as the strong CP problem. An odd question arises when one attempts to understand both quantum chromodynamics and charge parity symmetry. Why does quantum chromodynamics preserve CP symmetry even though there is no reason for QCD to preserve it? Before the CP problem is discussed, it is important to understand what a charge parity symmetry is. A charge parity symmetry is a multiplicative quantum number, or a set of quantum numbers whose products are preserved after a reaction, that describes the behavior of some particles under charge conjugation, which is an operation that replaces regular particles with antiparticles under equations that describe regular particles. CP symmetry essentially states that the laws of physics must remain the same if a particle were to be interchanged with the antiparticle in its particle equations. QCD seems to preserve this symmetry in spite of the fact that there is not a necessarily reason in chromodynamics that explains why it does. In the mathematics of quantum chromodynamics, there exist natural terms in the Lagrangian that should be able to break the CP symmetry, but yet there has yet to be any observed violation of the symmetry. So essentially what we are seeing here is that the symmetry is being broken by the mathematical equations, but the observations are not showing that it's happening. They call it it's widely considered to be the most underrated puzzle in physics. Anyways, in the QCD Lagrangian, a non-zero theta angle is where one would expect a CP violation, symmetry violation, to occur, which is natural and what should happen. It is predicted that if there is a massless quark in the standard model, there would exist no value for theta, thus eliminating it from the equation and unifying observational evidence with mathematical evidence. Except this does not happen. for there exists no massless quark in the standard model. As a result, this problem cannot be explained and solved through what is already known. There are several proposed solutions to this weird topic, two technically of which will be discussed in this chapter. The first proposed solution, which I'm suggesting myself, is to keep observing. Per usual, we may be missing something fundamental in our experiments, specifically the violation of CP symmetry. In no way can I claim to be an expert, and in no way can I suggest new experiments or methods of observation, but I know from experience that more observation means a greater understanding. I've been conducting an experiment myself for 5 years now, and I've discovered a pattern in nature. Let's just say it that way. I actually have been. It deals specifically with plants. It has nothing to do with astronomy, actually. It has very... Well, I mean, technically, it kind of does have stuff to do with astronomy. It kind of deals with the sun, but that's about it. That's about the majority of it. A lot of it has more to do with environmental science, blooming times, and other specific things that occur during the spring. Also, rain, sunlight, heat, all that. The leading proposal, though, to defeat the strong CP problem is known as the Peachy, I believe it is, the Peachy-Quinn theory, which involves another theorized elementary particle, the axion. In 1977, two physicists, Roberto Peachy, I'm not sure, and Helen, Women in Science, Quinn, proposed the addition of a theta term, which would be a CP symmetry-violating term to the Lagrangian in QCD. The theta term has never been measured in experimentation, so its value is widely considered to be near zero. The theory predicts the existence of a new elementary particle, the axion, through the fact that the theta value is explained by a dynamic field and through the fact that the particles arise through these quantum fields. The existence of the axion causes the field to have a value that naturally cancels, which results in the theta value of the Lagrangian to be zero. Now they said, oh yeah, like the theta value is already in the quantum chromodynamics Lagrangian, so... essentially, the axion and the field in which it exists naturally cancels, which removes that theta term from the existence, from whatever that's going on. And essentially, at that point, it essentially says that quantum chromodynamics does not violate at all CP symmetry. It follows it. Even mathematically. So the goal is to actually align the mathematical evidence with the observational evidence through the creation of new physics. This is what physics is. It's a combination of mathematics and theorization to find and learn about the universe. I honestly had some difficulty understanding this particular concept, though, so of course I've left a link down in the bibliography that will explain this in greater, more technical detail. Such a problem is a testament to how little is known about the universe, even in a cohesive and well-observed theory like QCD. The Peachy-Quinn theory, which being the leading theory, again requires another boson, which can make theories far more complicated to develop. The axion is a near massless. Its mass is predicted to be 10 to the negative 5th power to 10 to the negative 3rd power electron volts per the speed of light squared. Think of the smallest quarks were in the giga electron volts, so there's obviously a significant difference. A particle that will undoubtedly be exceptionally difficult to observe. Think about the neutrino. It took us so long to figure out what its mass was. We thought it was massless for a significant period of time, further complicating the process of solving the strong CP problem. These particles continue to hide in the shadows below our oblivious noses. Well-cemented theories that exist within complicated topics like quantum mechanics and new topics like the standard model particle physics are always fun to ascertain, for they are indicative of the beautiful and profound proliferation of the human knowledge in the face of mathematics and particle accelerators. In this chapter, we learned that quantum chromodynamics is a type of field theory known as a non-abelian gauge theory that unites the gluons and the quarks through this strong interaction. There are two main phenomena that compose QCD. First is color confinement, which states that attempts to separate different color charge quarks via the strong interaction does not separate the quarks, but rather creates another composite particle, a meson, and asymptotic freedom, which conveys a decrease in the relative strength of the strong interaction between gluons as the energy scales of the interactions increase and the distance scales decrease. Even QCD is fallible, for it contains some limitations that make it too an incomplete theory, just like the holy grail of physics, the Standard Model, which is incomplete. Anyways, though, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Again, if you would like to support the podcast, please click the link through the channel description and send a donation. As I say every episode, I have to pay for 12 years of college, so any donation would be greatly and profoundly appreciated. But anyways, take care and stay curious.